If he's convicted of, say, taxes or wire fraud, then he could run for office again. There's also the question about the timing of the investigation and the timing of the raid, with some claiming it is linked to a Department of Justice custom of not launching politically sensitive investigations less than 90 days before an election, such as this November's midterm elections. The fallout of the FBI search into Hillary Clinton's computer was considered by some to have severely damaged any chance that the former Secretary of State had at becoming president in 2016. The risk of repeating the same decision and the repercussions it might entail may well have loomed in the minds of FBI investigators. Michael Stern told Newsweek it wasn't clear why the 90-day custom would apply given that Donald Trump is not officially a candidate, at least not formally. That said, federal law enforcement will undoubtedly make an effort to avoid even the appearance of political motivation in actions like this, and so they have stayed outside the 90-day limit, Stern added. It is important to note that it is a protocol used by federal law enforcement and it is not a law. There may be times when a law enforcement action is so imperative that it is done within 90 days of an election. Michael Stern added, "Remember, the FBI conducted a search on a computer connected to Hillary Clinton and made a statement about it 11 days before a presidential election in which she was the Democratic nominee." Despite the FBI's apparent adherence to protocol, there are calls among some conservatives in the wake of the raid for the FBI to be dissolved and an investigation to be launched. It is worth noting that Donald Trump has a well-documented and complicated history with the FBI, with his dismissal of then-FBI Director, Director General James Comey, who oversaw the Clinton email probe, being perhaps the most publicized and controversial encounter. While some conservative commentators believe the raid on Mar-a-Lago is connected to a deep state operation engineered to overthrow right-leaning politicians, the fact remains that current FBI Director Christopher Wray was appointed by Donald Trump himself. But Christopher Wray has admittedly has attacked Donald Trump since then.
Ashura in Britain.
Part 1.
In 680 AD, there was a tragedy that would change the course of history and scar the face of the Muslim community forever. Muslims are ashamed, but also proud.
Actually, what we see is a manifestation of the human spirit, a yearning for justice.
On this day, Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, was brutally murdered along with members of his family. This was simply for his objection to the unscrupulous and unethical kingdom of Yazid.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was a senseless death in its way.
And why is the anniversary of his death, Ashura, commemorated throughout the world, even reaching Britain?
Why did Hussein stand and offer his blood? Was it just because he wanted to be killed, or there was a message. Or there was a message.
We go from the Prophet, we go from Ali, who suffered himself death at the hand of an assassin, and then we move to the next stage, which is the martyrdom of the Prophet's grandson. And so there is a kind of thread, spiritual threads, which connects them all up. And it's a thread which tells us about the fate of a righteous person, a fate of a righteous man.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave. He wanted this message to get through to the history, that look, when my grandfather talked about Islam, he did not talk about empire. He did not talk about the green palace of Damascus. He did not talk about armies. He did not talk about conquests. What he was concerned about was the spiritual life of Muslims.
It was these principles of Prophet Muhammad that were a source of great inspiration for Hussein. As a child, he looked up to his grandfather as the perfect role model. Prophet loved Hussein dearly.
We know that Hussein, as well as his brother Hassan, were much loved by the Prophet. And he had them on his knee and played with them. So it's quite a movie. Anybody who's been a father or a grandfather know how lovely that is. Imam Hussein was not just an ordinary man. He was a Prophet's grandson. And he was beloved by the Prophet. And indeed, Ali, the Lion of Islam, and the fourth Khalifa.
In fact, Hussein was loved throughout the entire region. During his life, Imam Hussein very quickly became prominent for his drive to help the poor and enrich the lives of orphans, activities for which his father, Imam Ali, had been renowned. For Hussein to have had someone like Imam Ali as a father was a distinct advantage.
He was a strong advocate of human rights. And he had problems with people engaging in high society gatherings where the poor would be ignored.
In fact, this line of the Prophet's family remains to this day a source of spiritual guidance for millions across the world.
They were strong believers in God because they were strong believers in justice. They were strong believers in humanity. The strong believers against oppression.
Their principles are studied to this day. Being part of this family, Hussein was well known for his exemplary morals. In fact, he is often compared to Jesus Christ, also a key figure in Islam.
What kind of a conversation would take place in between Jesus, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or Moses if they were in a room together today? All these personalities were the same light. They were the same light giving us the message of humanity. And they cannot be restricted to one faith or one faction, but they belong to the whole world.
Jesus had very great concern for the poor, widows and orphans. Those are all things that I've heard about from the life of Imam Hussein. And he would highlight their experience. So they would have had a lot in common to talk about in how the people at the bottom of society should be raised up to the top so that society was focused on caring for them. And one of the famous sayings of Jesus is, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. I'm not familiar with all the sayings of Imam Hussein, but I can imagine that he would have said something very similar, and they would have had a lot of similarities talking to each other.
Interestingly, this expression by Jesus reverberates in the Quran. As Hussein would talk amongst his followers, he would have recited this verse about being accountable on the Day of Judgment, that some will be lowered and others will be raised.
That is the last message that Imam Hussein alayhi salam gave to us, to speak against oppression, to speak against tyranny, to speak for the poor, to speak for the oppressed, to raise our voices, to help them.
The role of Imam Hussein mainly, principally, was to observe and enforce the enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil. And he was one man who would not bow down before the despotic and tyrant ruler like Yazid.
But who was Yazid? Quite simply, he was a tyrant, the repressive leader of a brutal regime. He had just been appointed by his father, Muawiyah, to rule over the Muslim world. This appointment would have a devastating effect on the history of Islam.
This was a point of no return. Should Islam or the leadership of Islam been kept in the hand of someone like Yazid, we would have now completely a different understanding of Islam. Perhaps we won't have Islam.
He was corrupt in the sense that he would allow mismanagement of the public affairs to be a norm. So it was a total corruption of the right and a total embracing of that which is anti-humanitarian, if you want to put it in those terms.
The Holy Quran considers justice to be the yardstick by which all merits should be measured. Essentially, how can you have peace of mind or peace in society when injustice boasts before your very eyes?
The life that Imam Hussein alayhi salam lives, it actually shouts opposition. He doesn't have to say anything, just the sheer lifestyle he lives, the sunnah he enacts, is a direct opposition to the lifestyle, to the worldview of the Umayyad dynasty. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam was proactive. He brought the war to Yazid.
Yazid knew that Imam Hussein rejected his leadership. This agitated him. He was also aware of people's hidden love for Hussein.
I think Yazid wanted, by obtaining the legitimacy of Imam Hussein, want to be confirmed in his own authority, and if did not feel confident that he was, and he must have been aware also of the degree of popular support that the Imam on his side. So it was an attempt to acquire legitimacy, and it was not a legitimacy which was merely, it was not just support of a particular faction, but it was a faction which was a prophet's line. And we know actually even successive caliphs try to get the successors of Imam Hussein on their side.
Yazid knew that he had two choices, either to obtain Imam Hussein's allegiance or to kill him. Either way, Hussein knew that he would not be safe to remain where he was living. Just as his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, all those years ago fled Mecca to Medina, Hussein was now leaving Medina to Mecca. Accompanying him were a small group of close relatives and loyal companions. Whilst Hussein was in Mecca, a movement had begun in a city called Kufa. They had heard of Hussein's refusal to pledge allegiance to Yazid and were gathering support to write letters requesting Hussein to take over leadership in their city.
It is recorded in the history that 18,000 people wrote letters to Hussein. As in some of those letters, we read, فَعَجَّلْ ثُمَّ عَجَّلْ Hurry and hurry, we are waiting for you.
The tragedy was that even in the sanctuary of Mecca, Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Prophet, was not safe. He was in danger, a conspiracy to kill him at the hands of the same people who claimed that they were followers of his grandfather.
I think this is one of those most tragic things, that someone like Hussein, peace be on him, had no other choice. He was left in among the Ummah, having no choice, no place to go. And he said, okay, they have told me that they would support me. I go to them and talk to them. And he continued moving.
Imam Hussein had actually sent an envoy to Kufa, his trusted cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil. This was to see if the people of Kufa really were committed to the pledge in their letters. On the other hand, Yazid became aware of the atmosphere in Kufa. In response, Yazid sent someone there to repress the uprising. This man was Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
In a matter of days, he changed the whole atmosphere of Kufa by threatening, by giving promise of wealth, by giving position to people. Suddenly, the whole ambience of Kufa was changed, which is very, very shameful, of course, a Muslim doing something like this for the promise of worldly issues.
Yazid's plan to quell the uprising in Kufa was successful. Imam Hussein's cousin was killed. On the way to Kufa, Hussein met a young man named Farazdak, who later became a famous Arab poet. He gave Hussein devastating news about the changes in Kufa and warned him against entering the city.
He said, "Qulubun nas ma'ak wa asyafuhum or suyufuhum alayk." The heart of the people are with you, but their swords are against you because they have sold the swords to Banu Umayyah, to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. So you are actually entering a city where people like you, but they are going to meet you with their swords.
Imam Hussein gathered his followers to tell them that the people of Kufa had turned against them.
And our followers, those who sent letters to us, have betrayed us. I just want you to be aware of this, where you are moving to.
In Kufa, Ubaydullah enforced a police state. No one was to enter or exit the city. It was a scary time.
At that time, a man came from Hamdan, a tribe in Yemen, for some business. He came to Kufa for some business and he was caught and he was arrested. And he said, "I didn't know. I have come just for business." And Ubaydullah thought that this is the best man to kill because he has no tribe here. We kill him to make an example out of him for others, that anyone capable of taking sword, remaining in Kufa, will be killed. And they killed the poor man, who was quite unaware of what was happening at all.
The army that Ubaydullah had sent was headed by Huwar, a military commander. His orders were simple: to capture Hussein and bring him to Kufa. Imam Hussein saw the army from a distance and waited.
Now, the beautiful thing is that Hussein had actually taken lots of water from the previous station. The first thing which appeared to Hussein, peace be on him, was that they were very thirsty. They had rushed. It was middle of the day. They had rushed. Some of them were on food. Some of them were on camels, on horses. And without asking them, "Why are you here? Are you enemies or are you friends?" he told his companions, "Bring the waters and let them drink. And also let the horses and camels drink."
This is abiding by the rules of war. He was abiding by, you know, the humanitarian values that are meant to be maintained when, you know, a Muslim is in the state of war. So offering water to those who are on the other side, Imam Hussein was always thinking about people as a whole, their destiny. He was always concerned for them.
This was the beautiful thing about it. The sad thing about it was that the first thing Hussein asked her is that, "Have you come to fight or have you come to support?" He said, "We have come to fight." And Hussein said, "La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." There's no power but the power of Allah.
Huwar wanted to arrest Hussein and take him to the Umayyads, but Hussein resisted. The interesting point was that because Huwar respected Hussein and didn't want a confrontation with him, he agreed to let him move in a direction away from Mecca until he received new orders from Ubaydullah. A while later, Huwar received this new order, and the order was to force Hussein and his followers to stop and remain where they were. By that time, they had reached one of the most hostile deserts in the region.
When things came to this point, Hussein, peace be on him, asked his companions, "What is the name of this place?" people, of course some of his companions were very familiar with the area, and they said, this is Nainawa. And he said, is there any other name? One of them said, this is Ghazariya. And he said, any other name? And one of them said, this special desert is called Karbala. And then Hussein said, Ardu Karban Wabala. This is distress and calamity and agony.
To add to the brutality, the now 30,000 strong army blocked the route to the nearby Euphrates River. This was so that Hussein and his followers would not have access to water.
And that is why the thirst was added to all that agony which was going on. And this actually made the Karbala the whole more tragic incident, that they not only killed the grandson of the Prophet, they killed him while he was thirsty, while his family were thirsty.
A particular detail which lingers in my memory is a terrible thirst, which Imam Hussein suffered during the siege. Karbala was actually quite protracted. You know, many people imagine it was just one go, but in fact, far more drawn out. So in a way, it conveys in a certain very dramatic way the extent of the suffering.
But the suffering would not end here. Hussein and his followers were cornered, with no routes for escaping. But they would not back down now. Hussein and his followers were ready to stand. With all the respect that Hussein had gathered through his life, why were people ready to kill him?
The Emir of Medina, a commander of the army, everyone, they respected Hussein. They knew that Hussein is not the type of man that they can put up a fight against. However, I don't know, in the heat of that situation, what happened? That people were somehow deceived. استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله, as we have in the Quran. Shaitan suddenly overcame them and they forgot ذكرullah and they forgot the people who were the people of Allah.
And in that treacherous heat of deception, the troops who had claimed to be Muslims were about to manifest an ugly face of brutality against the Prophet's grandson.
It was not something that was unexpected. They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
Whereas Imam Hussein had to do the ultimate sacrifice, and he wasn't a submissive person. He wasn't a lamb going to the slaughter. There was no instance of going there just for the sake of being killed. Imam Hussein, in fact, we know as a fact, he fought up to the last drop of his blood.
And Hussein was not only to sacrifice his life, but he was to sacrifice whatever he had and all those who were dearest to him.
There's no way you should compromise with injustice, and that's the example. It's the example with practically all the imams and certainly all the prophets. They displayed this courage. It's the inspiration that he gave everybody and still does today. It's pretty clear. And so it's a benchmark. He represents the ultimate sacrifice.
He would provide hope to all the oppressed today. And he would illustrate that numbers mean nothing if you're in the right. He would just mean hope. Numerical majority doesn't count when it comes to right and wrong.
Having the benefit of retrospect, we see how right Hussein was. I mean, he set the example in the history. There is no doubt about it. That is magnificent. The example that Hussein set in the history. I think he did something that his grandfather, the Prophet, peace be on him, expected from him to do, to somehow setting the standard against someone like Yazid.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
Thank you. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Recently, Labour's Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves was at pains to explain that the British government has lost control of the economy, adding that as families and pensioners worry about how they're going to pay their bills, the Tory leadership candidates are touring the country announcing unworkable policies that will do nothing to help people get through this crisis. We now present you an article written by Reza Javadi, a PhD student in British Studies at the University of Tehran. The piece is titled Truss vs. Sunak, Race for UK Leadership Heats Up Amid Looming Recession. Cutthroat race to number 10 Downing Street is in full swing, with two formidable figures and seasoned campaigners fighting it out for the coveted chair to replace Boris Johnson, who faced an unceremonious exit recently after a string of scandals rocked his government. Former British Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss are the remaining two candidates in the fray. Among 11 Conservative MPs who submitted their bids for the British premiership, Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old, spearheaded the rebellion against Boris Johnson when he announced his resignation as Chancellor of the Exchequer in early July, saying the public expects the government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. Born in southeast of England to Indian origin parents, Rishi Sunak, in his leadership campaign, has primarily focused on his family's immigrant roots in order to win the favour of his party and people. He has also pledged to implement the controversial Rwanda policy, which is an attempt by the British government to repatriate asylum seekers in the country to Rwanda, 4,000 miles away. The underdog in the race is opposed to cutting taxes and has said that he would wait for the inflation to subside before going on a tax-cutting spree. Interestingly, it was revealed earlier this year that his billionaire heiress wife had avoided millions of pounds in taxes, which prompted many to seek his resignation. Rishi Sunak, who was involved in the infamous Partygate scandal and fined by police for breaching the government's own COVID-19 protocol, has the shadow of many scandals that brought down Boris Johnson hovering over him. Thus, his popularity in the Conservative Party is profoundly influenced by his records in the cabinet. Liz Truss, a 46-year-old whose dogmatism may not help her in navigating the challenges of being at the helm, has pledged to slash $36 billion in taxes to be paid for through borrowing. According to a YouGov opinion poll for the Times newspaper carried out from 29th of July to 2nd of August, Liz Truss had the support of 60% of Conservative members versus 26% for Rishi Sunak, while the remainder of the nearly 1,000 members polled either were undecided or not planning to vote. Considering all of the existing factors, Liz Truss appears to have a slight edge over Rishi Sunak. Liz Truss, who was chosen by Boris Johnson first as the Trade Minister and then as Foreign Secretary, returned the favour by supporting Johnson when he was caught in the web of scandals and stood by him until his final weeks in office. Now she's gearing up to take his place at No. 10 Downing Street. Among her much-publicised plans to fix the country's economy is cutting taxes and decreasing the burden on Britons, which has been widely welcomed by members of the Conservative Party. Tim Bale, a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, is a close observer of the Conservative Party. He told CNN, "The average age of a party member is the late 50s. Just under half are of pensionable age, and they are predominantly white." Tim Bale added, "They mostly live in southern England and are financially comfortable. They support a strong line of law and order. They approve of low taxes." Given the cost of living crisis, the main challenge for people has been increasing taxes and sharp hikes in prices, which Liz Truss has promised to take up as the first priority of her premiership. While she believes that cutting taxes would give a flip to the economy, Rishi Sunak calls it fantasy economics by Truss, given the UK is still recovering from the economic shock of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both candidates are trying to appeal to the Conservative Party base at a time when the British economy is stagnant and has caused Britons to struggle with skyrocketing inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Recently, Labour's Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves was at pains to explain that the British government has lost control of the economy, adding that as families and pensioners worry about how they're going to pay their bills, the Tory leadership candidates are touring the country announcing unworkable policies that will do nothing to help people get through this crisis. The eventual winner will face the challenge of reviving Britain's economy. Weaker trade after Brexit, coronavirus pandemic, high energy prices following Russia's special operation in Ukraine, and a series of scandals under Boris Johnson's watch have all damaged the Conservative Party. The fears among leading Conservative members are growing over the fact that regardless of which candidate wins, the Conservative Party will end up being the main loser, given all the accusations that are being exchanged between the rivals to destroy one another. The last two candidates in the race will be trying to convince party members to back them at hustings events around the country until 31st of August. The party members, whose number reaches about 200,000, will give a postal vote then. The ballot will close on 2nd of September, with the winner due to be announced on 5th of September. While on the domestic front, the two Prime Minister hopefuls have contrasting stances, they appear to be on the same page on the country's foreign policy, especially the policy towards West Asia. According to parliamentary voting data, their views on issues affecting the region appear largely similar. Following Boris Johnson's deep footprint on most of the foreign policy matters, a Sunak government would mean a continuation of the same policy, supporting Western intervention in Syria and Iraq, continuing arms exports to Saudi Arabia, opposing Iran's peaceful nuclear program, supporting the Israeli regime's clandestine nuclear activities and destabilization plots in the region. Rishi Sunak's priorities are likely to be heavily domestic and suggest the continuation of the status quo. Liz Truss's prospective administration seems to have a clearer foreign policy approach in contrast to Rishi Sunak's, in line with their record in the cabinet. It will be interesting to see her stance on the restoration of the 2015 nuclear deal. As a top diplomat, she spoke of getting Iran back to the negotiating table, even though Iran never left the table in the first place. Britain's role in the Vienna talks as a member of the European Troika has been duplicitous. She is also expected to aggressively take up the cases of British nationals jailed in Iran for espionage. Regarding her policy towards the Arabian periphery states of the Persian Gulf, she is likely to strengthen ties with Arab states and promote her notion of a liberty network of the countries in the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC. Regardless of who takes the pole position, the next Prime Minister of Britain would have to focus more on domestic crises rather than poking their nose into other countries.
Qom Province, with an area of nearly 15,000 square kilometers, occupying less than 1% of the entire territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The province is linked to Tehran Province in the north, to Save, Tafresh, Ashtian, and Dilijan in Markazi Province in the south. It lies to the southeast of Isfahan, and from the east to Kabir Valley and Namak Lake. About one-fifth of the province is covered with mountains and foothills, with the remaining four-fifths a large valley or basin. The holy city of Qom is situated in the center of the province, close to the surrounding towns of Salafjagan, Khalajistan, Kahak, and Jafariya. Given its historic structures, discoveries of artifacts, and the recordings of historical documents, Qom was a reputable and relatively large city in the pre-Islamic era. When Islam was introduced to Iran, Qom developed rapidly and became semi-autonomous during the sovereign reign of the Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas caliphates. Qom is home to the heavenly court, the historic mausoleum and shrine of Hazrat Ma'sumeh. Also known as Fatimeh Ma'sumeh, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, the seventh Imam of Shia Islam. Hazrat Ma'sumeh is revered by Muslims worldwide, and so her resting place being in Qom lifted the dignity and status of the city and conferred religious significance upon it. Among the other notable tourist attractions in the province are the holy Jamkaran Mosque, and more than 400 other Imamzades, offspring of imams, shrines, seminaries, theological schools, historically important mosques such as Friday, Imam Hassan, Babul Jannah, and Raf'at, educational and international institutes, and Qomrud Lay. When the 7th Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun invited Imam Reza to Marv, Hazrat Ma'sumeh moved to Iran in the company of a number of Shia Muslims to meet with and join Imam Reza. But just outside Qom, she was taken ill. In her 80s at the time, she was bedridden in Qom for 17 days before she passed away. Her body was buried in a well-respected place in the city of Bagh Babylon. Today, Bagh Babylon is famous because of Hazrat Ma'sumeh's shrine that houses a magnificent monument. This stately edifice is one of the most important religious shrines of the Islamic world. The original shrine was built in the middle of the 3rd century Islam and was expanded substantially between the 4th and 6th centuries when a dome and artwork were added to it. Umm Azam Mosque, located right next to Hazrat Masume's mausoleum, is the city's Azam Mosque, known widely as Ayatollah Brujerdi's Azam Mosque. It was built in 1918 through the efforts of Sayyid Hossein Tabotabai Brujerdi. The architect of this splendid monument was a man named Hossein Lorzadeh. It is classified among the three largest veranda mosques. Its dome stands at 24 meters high. Today, the mosque is the Qom Seminary's most important teaching center. The mosque is now merged with Hazrat Masume's shrine. Recently, its dome was adorned with large thin flakes of lusterware, donated and produced under the supervision of Haj Hassan Jaber Ansari. The Tabotabai Mosque, spearheaded by Hujjatul Islam Agha Muhammad Tabotabai, the son of Ayatollah Haj Agha Hussein Qomi, a great mosque with an elevated dome, was built adjacent to Hazrat Masume's mausoleum. Famously known as the Tabotabai Mosque, it was built between 1981 and 1991. In the 10th century Islamic era, Shah Tahmasp Safavi used bricks to build the first sepulchre on the mosque. Sometime later, an additional sepulchre made of transparent white steel was installed around the original sepulchre and a wooden door was fitted in the northern frontage. In the 13th century Islamic era, Fath Ali Shah Qajar replaced this door with a luxurious golden door. He also upgraded the sepulchre by having it coated with layers of silver and installed on a malachite pillar. With time, the sepulchre lost its radiance, so in the 14th century in Islamic era, it was again renovated. Finally, in 1973, the form of the sepulchres was altered and its height increased. Fath Ali Shah Qajar had the shrine flagstoned with marble. He believed the spiritual gusts around Hazrat Masume's shrine has to step on the best of stones. Atiq Courtyard. In the 10th century in the Islamic era, Shah Begum Khatun, the daughter of Shah Ismail Safavi, built a square-form courtyard with three verandas. Later, Fath Ali Shah had it remodeled into an irregular octagonal shape. This octagonal form is said to have been built on the memorial of Imam Reza Thaman al-Hujjaj, the brother of this holy woman. pointing to the fact that Imam Reza was the 8th Shia Imam. Gradually, the number of verandas in the courtyard increased. At the moment, it has 7 of them, 4 on the south side and 3 on the north. The verandas of the Atiq courtyard are the most famous within this court. They were built on the order of Shah Begum and gilded during the reign of Fath Ali Shah Qajar. They constitute the entrance of the heavenly courtyard. Atop each veranda, a hadith inscription in white thulf is displayed on an azure background. Above it, a myriad of tiles and inscriptions. Imam Khomeini Great Sanctuary. It is one of the greatest architectural feats after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, featuring a multitude of porches, entrances, and other facilities. Called Balasar, overhead mosque, it is situated nearby and overhead to Hazrat Masume's shrine. That's where it draws its name. In the Safavid period, it served as a motel. Inside the shrine and next to the holy tomb of Hazrat Masume, a mausoleum houses the eternal resting places of grand ayatollahs, scholars, and outstanding scientific and religious figures, the largest grouping of revered Muslims anywhere, particularly in the Shia world. Qum is called Darul Aman. Some of the renowned and compassionate scholars buried in the mausoleum here are Allamez Tabatabai, Khansari, Golpayegani, and Bahjat. Martyr of love and writing and eminent ideologist Murtaza Mutahhari is also buried here. In the INM mirror courtyard of the Holy Shrine lies the mausoleum of freedom crusader Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, born in 1843 and killed in 1909. Sheikh Nuri's memorial is symbolic among the liberal crusaders of constitutionalism. This is the tomb of martyr Ayatollah Dr. Mufatteh. He was born in 1889 and martyred in 1939. The Faizia Theological School was founded in the Middle Ages of Islamic history and is located in Qom next to Hazrat Masume Shrine in Astane Muqaddase, Holy Threshold Square. It was registered as a national heritage in 2007. Astane School was replaced by Faizia School in the first half of the 13th Islamic century. According to valid historical documents, the school was established in the middle of the 6th Islamic century and was renovated in the Safavid era. The two-story building features 4 verandas. The 40 chambers on the first floor were built in the Qajar period, and the other 40 on the second floor were built in the 14th Islamic century. The oldest part of the seminary is where the southern veranda is and is decorated with beautiful tiles belonging to the Safavid era of 1939 AH. It is regarded as the gateway to the Atir courtyard and Hazrat Masum's shrine. The Museum of Astan and Muqaddase, the Holy Threshold, is one of the oldest in the country, constructed in 1935 inside the Holy Shrine of the Martyr Mutahhari Mosque. Its curatorial activities continued until 1974. Located in Astan Square, the museum building was built a couple of years after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Originally, it covered an area of 500 square meters, but in 1992, the building's basement was added to the museum, increasing its total usable area to 1,000 square meters. The oldest Quran in the museum dates back to 819 AD, and there's the name of Ma'mun Abbasi on the first page. Some of the Qur'ans are written on animal skin, some on fabric, and the rest on paper. The collection within the museum has various parts and includes handwritten Qur'ans from the second Islamic century to those written in the contemporary period, coins from Islamic and pre-Islamic eras, painted tabloids and miniatures, wooden works of art including marquetry and parquetry, terracotta, bowls, glass bowls and golden inlaid tiles with designs and beautiful inscriptions belonging to the 6th and 8th Islamic centuries, stone masonry works and decorative stones, metal instruments and engravings, hand-woven silk carpets from the Safavid and Qajar eras, and hand-woven fabric. Samples of expensive marquetry are kept in the Museum of Astan e Muqaddase in Rome. One such sample is a rare marquetry door belonging to the Qajar period, built when Nasiruddin Shah Qajar was in power and Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir was vizier, and forms part of the tomb of Muhammad Shah Qajar. Another marquetry piece from the Qajar period, with inscriptions of famous poems by Muhtasham Kashani describing Ashura in Nasta'lir calligraphy, are engraved beautifully on bones. The Chehel Akhtaran Shrine in Qom. The mausoleum of Musa Mubarqa, son of Imam Muhammad Taghi, and other offspring of the Imam. That's why the large courtyard of this collection contains three popular shrines, the Musa Mubarba, the Chehel Akhtaran, and the Imamzada Zaid. The monument was built in 1571. Ordered by Shah Tahmasp Safavid, it was designed by Master Sultan Rumi, who was amongst the most famous architects of the Safavid era. His name is recorded in the shrine. In 1574 AD, the building's roof was renovated with brick. The ceiling is very high. A number of Sayyids and offspring of Imams are buried here. They include the sons and offspring of Imam Musa Mubarak. It is said that a total of 40 men, 40 women, and 25 children are entombed in this shrine. The library of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi. Sayyid Shahabuddin Husseini Marashi Najafi was born in 1897 in Najaf and passed away in 1990 at the age of 93. He led a frugal existence. He is famous for salvaging thousands of rare and lost Islamic books at his own expense. His library holds the world's largest collection of Shia manuscripts. The oldest undated manuscript in this library is the pages of the Holy Quran written in Kufi, going back to the 2nd and 3rd Islamic centuries. And the oldest dated manuscript is two parts of the Quran written in Kufi by Ali ibn Hilal in Baghdad in 1013. There is also a golden page of the Holy Quran in the collection bearing Imam Reza's handwriting. Now the manuscripts of the library number 60,000, 65% of them in Arabic and the rest in Persian, Turkish, Urdu, Tartari, Hibachi, Pahlavi, and Latin. Annually, between 750 and 1,000 manuscripts are added to this library. Marashi Najafi wrote more than 148 books, dissertations, and papers in his lifetime. Most of them are yet to be published. Qom's traditional bazaar, scented with perfumes, has played host to travelers from far and wide who come here to buy souvenirs such as sohan, mohrs, prayer stones, and sajadehs or prayer mats. The aroma of fresh sohan, made next to the retail shops, draws every tourist and pilgrim to itself. Qom's Grand Bazaar houses a beautiful historical monument, located near the mausoleum of Hazrat Masumeh. It bears the hallmarks of the Qajar-era architectural style and was registered as a National Heritage Site in 1997. The building has two floors with 12 chambers. It used to have long cloth sashes that are now mostly ruined. Above the chambers and the vaulted corners is chalk architecture. The roof of the shopping center has three openings and the middle section opens up to a height of 15 meters. The market has an arched roof, considered the largest in Iran. The monument was designed and executed by Master Hussein Rumi in 1882. Custodianship of the monument was granted to Sayyid Mahmud Tabatabai, a recognized businessman in Qom and the father of Sayyid Hussein Tabatabai. The mosque in the old square of Qom is 900 years old. And atop its fine architecture is the first minaret and dome built in Iran, and the third in the Islamic world.